Calling someone colored is going to get you decked in the USA. However, in South Africa, it's not offensive. It's the name of an ethnic group. In fact, genetic studies have suggested that the colored people of South Africa have the highest levels of mixed ancestry in the world. Calling someone colored in the USA sounds like a derogatory comment from the 1960s. But in South Africa, it's like saying, "Hey, there's that Mexican guy." Maybe we're a little bit more sensitive about race in the USA than they are over there. There is a word that will certainly get you decked, or maybe killed in the USA, and that's the N-word, which I won't say here because I hope to become famous someday, and I wouldn't want this taken out of context. The N-word doesn't hold the same negativity in South Africa. However, they do have a word with the same societal undertones, the K-word, kafir. Just like how the N-word originates from the Spanish word for black, kafir, or the K-word, originates from Arabic. It similarly has taken a new meaning. Sorry if I'm offending any of my audiences in South Africa. I'm an ignorant American. Just like in America, saying the K-word is how people describe it in South Africa. It is extremely offensive. In America, we occasionally have someone drop the N-word, and it shocks the populace. In South Africa, saying the K-word can get you sentenced up to 10 years in jail. Or more commonly, you can get a hefty fine placed on you. But I digress. The Daily Show is a show that my generation, the millennial generation, grew up with. And as a teenager, I remember first learning about the troubles of the world through the voice of Jon Stewart. Stewart has since retired and handed the mantle over to a new host, Trevor Noah, who is a colored South African. He grew up in South Africa during the waning days of apartheid and explains in his autobiography, Born a Crime. In South Africa during apartheid, mixing with other ethnic groups was illegal under a law called the Immorality Act of 1927. The penalty was up to 5 years imprisonment for the man and 4 years imprisonment for the woman. As a child, he remembers his black Xhosa mother had to pretend to be a stranger with him when they were out in public. She had a colored neighbor who would pretend to be Trevor's mother so she could take him to the park without fear of harassment or getting arrested by the authorities. In apartheid South Africa, it wasn't illegal to be a colored person of mixed ancestry, but it was illegal to have a lover of a different race. If the authorities, or for that matter, another person in the apartheid police state told the authorities about him, his mother could have been arrested. And as a matter of fact, she was, numerous times, for illegally entering white neighborhoods, which she did to be closer to Noah's white father. The two were segregated from one another. Trevor Noah's father was a white Swiss man and lived in a white neighborhood. Noah's African mother was unable to visit the neighborhood. It was illegal for a black person to visit a white neighborhood. So in order to see his father, she would have to forge work documents in order to sneak in. It was also illegal for non-whites to live in white neighborhoods, but non-whites could still enter to clean and do menial jobs. Sometimes Noah's mother got caught and would spend weeks in jail. Normally, she would bribe the authorities to get out. Trevor recalls seeing his father as a young child and excitedly chasing him, yelling, "Daddy!" And his father ran away out of fear of being arrested. The little colored baby thought it was a game and would chase after his father. Apartheid South Africa was a police state. Neighbors and random members of the community frequently worked with the police to make sure everything ran as it should. The goal in this apartheid state was to be white, the highest race, or the top of the hierarchy, leaving the other races, colored, Indian, and on the bottom, black, in their respective race-based hierarchical positions. In 1652, the Dutch founded Cape Town in the very south of Africa. The goal of this colony was to be used as a way station on the long trek to the Dutch East Indies, located in modern-day Indonesia. The Khoikhoi, or Khoisan, were the first natives that made contact with the Dutch settlers. The Khoi and the San people spoke the same language and shared the same ethnic group, with similar tribal backgrounds. However, they would oftentimes war with one another, and it wasn't limited to Khoi versus San. They would often fight within the many different tribes. The Khoikhoi people were enraged when they went on their seasonal visit to graze cattle at the foot of the Table Mountain, located near modern-day Cape Town, where the Dutch had settled. They found European foreigners disrupting and farming their land, leading to the Khoikhoi Dutch Wars. When they made contact with the Dutch, many of the disunified tribes fought the Dutch. However, in a story far too common in history, the natives refused to set aside their differences and continue fighting each other instead of the European newcomer. Over the course of a few wars, the Dutch eventually prevailed above the Khoisan. The Dutch not only defeated them with superior weaponry, but also vassalized them, defeating some tribes while others eventually began to work for the Europeans, feeding them with their advanced animal husbandry skills. The Europeans used their rifles to defend water positions, which in turn the many tribes would try to take and fail to take. Eventually, the remaining Khoikhoi people submitted. The final conclusion of the Khoikhoi-Dutch Wars is that the Khoisan people, along with their culture, was completely wiped out in a complex struggle balancing potential prosperity with cultural identity. The complexity of the disappearance of the Khoisan from influence in southern Africa is often seen as the Khoisan trading away their influence for livestock. The truth is, the resistance of the Khoisan was a response and a reaction to the dispositions of the Boers. The downfall of the Khoisan came at the hands of violence that is often overlooked when considering the ethnic identities that vanished from the African continent in the 17th and 18th centuries. Only about 100,000 of them exist in South Africa today. The Dutch brought in Boers, the Dutch word for farmers, to supply the newly developing South African colony, at the time known as the Cape Colony. Dutch traditional practices left all the land to the first male son, so an explosion of Dutch growth began, expanding well past the borders of the Cape Colony. This annoyed the Dutch East India Company, who didn't want to create more conflict with the natives. With the European ability to farm land, the ancient way of life for the local African peoples was disrupted. Dutch became the most common language throughout the area, by Europeans and natives alike. Now, the native peoples of South Africa aren't homogenous. Africa is the most genetically diverse continent on the planet, leading to more confusion in the story. In the USA, for example, during segregation, you were either considered white or non-white, a first or second-class citizen. For example, when the Irish came to the USA in mass numbers during the early 20th century, they were treated as second-class citizens. However, eventually they integrated and became white. Race and ethnicity in South Africa isn't that simple. A lot of it goes into tribal grounds, which can be painstakingly confusing, to downright impossible to understand. Ethnicity plays a major role even today in South African politics, and can be divided among racial, ethnic, tribal, and linguistic grounds, just in the black community. Languages are not culture groups, even though in the West we tend to generalize them as such. Languages can combine and hybridize with other languages over time. Under apartheid, you were classified as either white, Indian, colored, or black. But the native blacks had numerous tribes, including the Zulu, Xhosa, Sotho, Nguni, Khoe, San, among many others. They oftentimes fought with one another, as well as the Europeans. As put by one Redditor, the tribalist stuff is complicated. The category Xhosa and Zulu are sort of colonial-era classifications. Prior to colonization, there was more clan identity than this ethnic group identity. The missionaries grouped people based on their flawed understanding of history and language, and so very disparate groups were grouped together, which is part of why the Bantustans failed. They also failed because they were racist enterprises designed to oppress people, but internally they struggled with internal issues between clans and traditional leadership. For example, there are Zulu people today whose ancestors fought against Shaka Zulu and the Zulu Empire. They are Zulu today because that's what the government has told them for a century. Having a common enemy can be a source of identity. Shaka even hired Boer mercenaries for some of his battles. About 150 years after the Dutch and Khoisan people first made contact, the Dutch and the French went to war with each other during the Napoleonic times, and the British took the Cape Colony from the Dutch in order to prevent their rival, the French, from taking it. The British and the Dutch didn't mix. The Dutch had numerous restrictions placed on them, including the banning of their language, Dutch. Actually, they spoke a Dutch dialect called Afrikaans. Another thing that infuriated the Dutch was that when the Boer farmers were attacked by the natives, the British did little to protect them. The Dutch loathed the British, so approximately one-tenth of the Cape Colony escaped north and east in something called Die Groot Trek, or the Great Trek, where they ran into the Bantu peoples. Now, this is where things can get a bit controversial. Depending on who you ask in South Africa, white-descended Europeans or black natives, the Europeans, aka Afrikaners, or British, developed a theory called the Empty Land Myth, whereby the lands of North Cape Colony had been heavily depopulated in the years prior to this by a Zulu warrior named Shaka Zulu. It has been estimated that between 1 to 5 million Africans had been killed as a result of the conquest of Shaka Zulu. This paved the way for the Dutch to set up new states, free of British rule. Shaka Zulu's Mfukane, which in Zulu means the crushing or forced migration, was a period of widespread chaos and warfare among indigenous ethnic communities in the east of southern Africa, during the period between 1815 and about 1840, right at the beginning of the Boer Great Trek. The Europeans claim that the lands of northern and eastern South Africa had been depopulated and were therefore vacant or deserted, and thus the land was free to claim, and in turn, today theirs. However, black South Africans, using archaeological evidence, have claimed this is not true, pointing that the Bantu peoples have been in the region since at least 300 AD, and that a greater mass migration of Bantu peoples occurred in 12,000 AD. According to Professor John Wright of Columbia University, although the Mfukane caused a decrease in the population of the eastern part of South Africa, the resulting consolidation of larger settlements and political power is not, according to some sources, believed to have left vast stretches of pasture land uncontested. How many people died as a result of this conflict is unknown, but the death toll is estimated, cited most frequently at about 1 to 2 million. In the 70 years or so after 1760, the political face of the region north of the Orange River and east of the Kalahari was profoundly changed. Probably the truth lies somewhere in the middle. Another aspect of the empty land myth is that it silences the existence of the Khoisan. However, South African scholars tend to struggle along tribal and race lines, even to this day, to where academia has disputes among a centralized black majority or tribal lines. This has become a crucial part of South African history. Heated debates occur in the South African Parliament over what to do with the land of South Africa. Land expropriation is a major dispute. White farmers own 73% of the farmland in South Africa and make up 9% of the population. Where the majority of the black population lives in absolute poverty, a direct result of the apartheid-era policies, which saw native blacks dispossessed of their land without compensation. Julius Malema's Economic Freedom Fighters, EFF, wants to expropriate land, as well as mines and banks, without compensation. The white minority owns most of the country's best land because of the Land Act of 1913. At the stroke of a pen, black people were dispossessed of their farms. They were left with just 13% of the land.
In all the hearings, I even commented and said, I'm still to meet a white person who support expropriation of land without compensation. So why are you shocked? I see leaders of the EFF and everybody responding to Donald Trump. I don't have time for nonsense. I expected this. And more backlash is going to come. If South Africans are not ready to expropriate the land because they are scared of sanctions, they are scared of backlash, then don't vote for the EFF. Because you vote for us, we are going to expropriate land. And Donald Trump will come for us. And Britain will come for us. And the EU will come for us. I said this throughout my life in the movement, that for everything good comes the pain before. If you're not prepared, South Africa, to take the pain, then forget about the land. Donald Trump has not said anything extreme. Things are still going to come. I hope the Zuma group in the ANC, which is supporting this thing, they know the consequences. We know the consequences. We know that the first response will be killing. They will kill us for that. There's a group of white right-wingers who are being trained by Jews in Pretoria to be snipers. Snipers. They are training in a farm in Pretoria. We know it. To be snipers. So we know that death is the first price we are prepared to pay. The second price we are prepared to pay for this land is poverty. They will close taps. It's a war.
Malema has been accused by the white minority of instigating black youth to attack white farmers.
I live in Bronkhorstspruit, and in 2008, the 20th of the September of November, the night, we were attacked. I was shot through the back, and my wife, unfortunately, was killed. But I want to say to Malema today, who is the big instigator of farm murders, I want to challenge him today. I will give him a rifle. I will load it. And I will stand still so that he can finish what they began. But I want to see if he's a man, because he can shout out to the youngsters and tell them to go and murder the farmers on their farms. But I want to give him a weapon so that he can come and shoot me where everybody can see that, so that he can show whether he's a man or whether he's a mouse.
Malema himself was convicted in 2011 for singing the song Shoot the Boer. The song is an apartheid-era struggle song that has been accused of promoting violence against white South Africans.
Shoot to kill, Mumasa. Shoot to kill, kill a man. Kiss the poor, the farmer. Kiss the poor, the farmer. Brr, pa, pa. Brr, pa, pa. Attention.
This is Malema singing Shoot the Boer. Malema, after being convicted, still continued to sing the song with the modified lyrics Kiss the Boer. Many white South Africans, especially farmers, fear they are being targeted based on race, and that the attacks are increasing in the post-apartheid country, where race has played such a key factor. The African National Congress and other analysts maintain that farm attacks are part of a broader crime problem in South Africa and do not have a racial motivation. According to South African police statistics, there were 21,325 murder victims in 2019, of which 49 were white farmers. White South Africans make up approximately 9% of the country's population. These accusations of race-based white farm murders have been linked to far-right conspiracy theories, such as the Great Replacement or Replacement Theory, a theory used by white nationalists that claim the white European ethnic group is being systematically replaced, bred out, or killed by non-white groups. Scholars have generally dismissed the claims of a Great Replacement as being rooted in an exaggerated reading of immigration statistics and unscientific racist views. South Africa has the 9th highest rate of intentional homicide in the world. Statistics would agree with the ANC's comments on the matter. Many in South Africa blame Nelson Mandela and the ANC for not going far enough on land redistribution or expropriation. The story of Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe are often brought up. When the ANC took over after the fall of the apartheid regime, they sought to provide compensation for land dispossessed from natives in the past by providing monetary compensation. The same Redditor, as previously mentioned, explained the situation in his family. The other example would be my grandmother. She was forcibly relocated from Umbukane to Komashu. And then about 10 years ago, the government said they could compensate her for her land being stolen. They gave her something like 15,000 rand, which is about 1,000 US dollars, for her entire life being uplifted, for her family being moved in the middle of the night with no notice, for tanks demolishing her house and land. The land was stolen. It was easily worth 100 to 200 times that amount. But she was also deprived of an education and lived in dire poverty, so she accepted this offer. These situations are why Malema's EFF is so popular. These monetary compensation plans were largely seen as failures, leading to more anger. As of early 2006, the ANC government announced that it will start expropriating the land. But, according to the country's chief land claims commissioner, Tozi Gwanya, unlike in Zimbabwe, there will be compensation to those whose land is expropriated. But it must be a just amount, not inflated sums. On the 20th of December 2017, the ANC-led government announced at the 54th National Conference that it would seek to amend Section 25 of the South African Constitution regarding property rights to implement land expropriation without compensation, EWC. At the conference, a resolution was passed to grant ownership of traditional land to the respective communities, about 13% of the country, usually registered in trusts like the Ingonyama Trust, under the name of traditional leaders to the respective communities. In February 2018, the Parliament of South Africa passed a motion to review the property ownership clause of the Constitution to allow for the expropriation of land in the public interest without compensation, which was widely supported within South Africa's ruling party on the grounds that the land was originally seized by the whites without just compensation. South African officials claim that the land reforms will be different from Zimbabwe's land reforms, and that South Africa's plan is constitutional and subject to laws and constitutions, unlike Zimbabwe's process, which was overseen by Robert Mugabe. However, the process in Zimbabwe was also carried out by a constitutional amendment, signed into law on the 12th of September 2005, that nationalized farmland acquired through the fast-track process and deprived original landowners of the right to challenge in court the government's decision to expropriate their land. I wanted to give a shout-out to my Patreon supporters, Madan Muthu, Lindsay Lee McCormick, Grimbot, and Aaron Hansen. Thanks so much, guys. You're the reason the show survives. For a full version of this episode, you can find it on my Patreon account. The full version of this episode includes some interviews with some people from South Africa, some farmers, as well as a more detailed explanation of the native tribes of the area. Thanks again, guys. In 1834, slavery was banned all throughout the British Empire, including the Cape Colony. To get around this, the remaining Dutch in the British regions of Cape Colony, located in the south, instituted the Cape Articles of Capitulation, which effectively changed the status of slaves to indentured laborers. However, some decided to claim the quote-unquote empty land to the north. The Dutch set up two republics, Transvaal, so named because it was north of the Vaal River, and the Orange Free State. Both states would later show up on the apartheid-era flag of South Africa. After diamonds and gold were discovered in the Dutch republics in the late 1800s, the British wanted to form a union over all of the regions of modern-day South Africa, including the Dutch republics. The Boer states, by the 1870s, were entering bankruptcy. From constantly having to fight off neighboring African tribes, the British annexed Transvaal in response, and after a few years, the Dutch rose in rebellion, leading to the First Boer War. The First Boer War was dominated by guerrilla warfare from the Dutch Boer Afrikaners. By the way, I want to make a note. These three names can and will be used synonymously from here on out. Dutch, Boer, and Afrikaner are all the same people. All Boers between the ages 16 and 60 could be conscripted into the army, which was more of a militia. They would have to bring with them a horse and enough food for 8 days. The Boers were excellent marksmen, made even better by the British wearing their bright red uniforms, making them easy targets. The British were crushed by the Boers. This was the first British defeat since the American War of Independence. In 1881, a treaty was signed that recognized the Boer republics. However, just 3 to 4 years later, the Europeans began meeting in Berlin to discuss the colonization of the Dark Continent, called so because it, Africa, was unknown, not because of skin color. With the Berlin Conference, the scramble for Africa was underway. No colonial power wanted to miss out on the vast riches and prestige to be had in Africa. On a summer's day in 1886, two prospectors discovered gold on a Transvaal farm called Longlakte. Gold was not new to the Transvaal. Africans had mined gold hundreds of years earlier. More recently, gold had been found in the eastern Transvaal. In most cases, this gold ran out, forcing small mining towns to close down. The gold found at Longlakte was different. The gold discovered there ran for miles and miles underground, an endless treasure of gold. The small town of Longlakte became part of a big mining camp called Johannesburg, where many other mining camps had been set up. Soon, Johannesburg became the biggest town in Transvaal, bigger than even Pretoria, the capital. The bankrupt Republic of Transvaal was no longer bankrupt. It was now the richest gold mining area in the world. Men traveled en masse to Transvaal. They walked, rode on horseback, or came by ox wagon. Ships no longer passed South Africa on their way to Australia and New Zealand. Instead, boatloads of men arrived at the ports and hurried to catch the next coach to Transvaal, hoping to find the riches of their dreams. This gold led Transvaal to rival the British for power and dominance in southern Africa. The British, who saw themselves haughtily as the supreme commander, couldn't have this. Kaiser Wilhelm, the Emperor of Germany at the time, sent a letter of congratulation to the Boer republics for their victories in defiance of the British during the First Boer War. This worried the British, who foresaw a Boer-German alliance. Starting in 1899, the British began raiding the Boers. The British, who went by the nickname Khakis, due to their recently changed khaki-colored uniforms, they learned from the First Boer War that bright red uniforms weren't the best for combat. Both Winston Churchill and Mahatma Gandhi saw action in this war. At the Battle of Spionkop, Churchill served as a war correspondent. Gandhi was there as well, working as an auxiliary to the British Volunteer Ambulance Corps. About 9,000 Indians saw combat on the side of the British. Eventually, the raids turned into a full-blown invasion. The British wanted control of the Boer gold. The native black tribes found themselves mostly on the side of the British. However, some did fight for the Boers. Some 10,000 blacks fought for the Dutch Boers. And on the side of the British, it is estimated that about 100,000 black natives fought for the crown. The war was a particularly brutal one. The Second Boer War turned into a guerrilla nightmare, where the Boer people eventually became convinced the British were trying to eradicate them. This feeling was exacerbated by the Boer civilians, who declared neutrality and would then become targets of the Boer militias, who saw them as traitors. The British responded by erecting proto-concentration camps to protect the civilians. This became a propagandist dream, or depending on your side in the war, a nightmare. To add to the propaganda, General Cous de la Rey, a Boer, who won an important battle at Magersfontein, returned the British prisoners of war because he was unable to feed them, including a captured British general, Methuen. Once again, this added to the nationalistic Boer mentality of, we are the good guys, and they are the evil British trying to enslave and exterminate us. The British used scorched earth tactics. This forced the Boer civilians into concentration camps, where the conditions became more horrid day by day. For the native blacks, conditions were even worse. They were forced into segregated camps, which received even less resources than their white counterparts. Many black men joined the British army in order to get rations of food, just to survive. In 1901, the British camps were overrun with disease, lung infections, measles, typhoid, among others. While the men fought in commando formations, where the English word commando comes from, mostly the elderly, women, and children suffered in these camps. A report after the war concluded that 27,972 Boers, of whom 24,074, 50% of the Boer child population, were under the age 16, had died in the camps. In all, about 1 in 4, 25% of the Boer inmates, mostly children, died. These people were victims of both negligence and the lack of information about these diseases at the time. Concentration camps were a new thing, and the world was unaware of what happens when a large number of people were shoved into a small, dirty place. Even the British considered the conditions of the camps to be horrid. The Boer War ended with an agreement between the Boers and the British, where the Boers swore an allegiance to the British crown, and in return, they were given complete domination over the natives. Afrikaans, the Dutch dialect, would remain the language used in the new British colony, and the black and colored native Africans would be forced into subservience to the Dutch colonists. The conditions of the First and Second Boer Wars led to a resentment towards the British that never went away, and played heavily into the anti-British resentment that carried itself into the 20th century, including the First and Second World Wars, where the South Africans found themselves fighting for the British crown.